Sean now on 086 60 25,000.
Well, hello and a very good morning to you on this beautiful morning. It's 10 past 10 on the Sean Doherty Show. Good to have your company. Lines open right now for your calls and for your comments and your thoughts. So if you want to get in touch with us, you know what to do. It's text 086 60 25,000 or phone on 074 91 25,000. You can also visit us at Facebook and we're there at Sean Doherty Show. So please feel free to get in touch. We'd love to hear from you on the programme this morning. I'm just taking a quick look through the papers today. The Irish Times has got the Donald Trump story on the front page, and the Trump administration facing increased pressure last night over its links with Russia after emails showed that Donald Trump Jr. enthusiastically welcomed an offer of information on Hillary Clinton linked to the Russian government. National Maternity Hospital criticised over pay breaches. That's another story there. And, of course, this story on drink driving, proposals to automatically ban anyone found to be over the legal drink driving limit from the roads were opposed by six ministers at yesterday's cabinet meeting. The Irish Independent today has got bill hikes, families to pay more levies. Families are facing a triple whammy of charges as soon as the summer ends. Hikes in electricity charges, higher waste costs, and back to school expenses are set to hit parents hard in the pocket. The Irish Daily Mail today has got she stabbed him, then took hours to call 999. The mother who stabbed her autistic toddler to death waited hours before calling 999, claiming he had suffered a heart attack. Dreadful story. We talked about it yesterday. So sad. The Irish Daily Star has got Hutch Gang's IRA summit. The Irish Sun is leading with I Feel Like Willy Wonka. The lad who sold the winning Euro Millions ticket last night said, I feel like Willy Wonka. Wonder how the winner feels then. The Irish Daily Mirror today, family scoops 29 million lotto. A family has scooped the mega 29 million jackpot. It has been revealed. The Donegal Post, could tragedy have been averted? There have been calls for more extensive warning signage at Donegal piers relating to local tides, currents, risks and dangers. The move comes after it emerged that the two men who perished at sea over the weekend off Malinbeg were on the same inflatable rib that was brought to shore by the Coast Guard only a matter of weeks ago after breaking down. The Inish Times today, damning report on Inishowen Tourism Society made public. The long-awaited report into Inishowen Tourism Society has been made public as a result of an Inish Times Freedom of Information request. The Croagh Horwath review of governance arrangements at Inishowen Tourism Society was completed in December last, but had remained unpublished until today. The source of much speculation in the peninsula, the report said its findings and recommendations were designed to position Inishowen Tourism for the future and to strengthen its governance arrangements. Right, we are going to move over to the story in the Finn Valley Voice, which is that parents are outraged at vandalism in Stranorla Playground. Local parents have condemned an act of vandalism at Ardmacool Playground. The vandalism happened at lunchtime on Monday. Three young teenagers have been observed on CCTV cameras breaking signs and lifting drain covers and tearing holes in the rubber playground surface. So we've had a few incidents quite similar recently in relation to this kind of activity in Inishowen, and of course now in the Finn Valley, and of course in Letterkenny as well. While police in Derry are investigating the death of a six-year-old boy, the six-year-old died yesterday afternoon. Joining us on the line is Gareth Cross. First, we're going to chat to Gareth. He's a reporter with the Derry News. Gareth, what do we know about this very sad event?
Well, it was just shortly before 10:30 yesterday. He was found injured on the road, and Danica, young six-year-old Danica McGuire, and he was taken to hospital, where he subsequently passed away. police who's since been released on bail.
And do we know anything else about the circumstances surrounding his death?
Well, neighbours and stuff have spoken out. They were just saying, you know, that he was just playing in the street, and the next thing, you know, they heard an almighty screaming. They rushed out and, you know, found him significantly injured. There's not really much details at the time. I think police are still investigating. They're looking for witnesses to come forward.
Okay, I just want to go over to Karen Mullen, the Sinn Féin MLA. Karen, I know you weren't at the scene yesterday, but what do you know about what happened?
Just there, what Gareth has said, you know, the tragic events as the young boy was found injured, and unfortunately, through all the efforts of the emergency services, they weren't able to save his life, and he died shortly afterwards. This is a community in deep shock. You can imagine, yesterday, I think it's the first day we've had sunshine for the summer holidays, and the children are off school. You know, that it is a safe neighbourhood. Children do play. They play together. And it is such a tragedy in the school holidays. It's a parent's worst nightmare.
Yeah, just describe the area to us. I mean, the children would be playing in that area. That's nothing unusual.
No. And in this day and age, as you know, it's great to see that children are out playing, because we're in a world of technology and a lot of children are stuck inside. But within our community, you know, those streets are safe. There's a great community sense, spirit. Neighbours look out for one another. There's all our children that you know, live side by side. And I'm led to understand they had a number of wee friends and they would have come out to play. And as I say, yesterday was a lovely day, and it just ended so tragically.
Young Donoghue Maguire was just 6 years of age. You didn't know Karen, his family?
No, I don't know his family. My colleague Alicia McKellen had went down. We're not too far away, and we knew that something really badly had happened, and they got on the scene shortly afterwards, and that neighbours, they were just in such a state. Everybody had tried their best, but unfortunately it has ended so tragically.
And Karen, were you saying earlier that the family had recently relocated to Derry?
Yes, we believe that to be true. That's what we've been told. They had moved back here to Derry, a number of months ago. But I wouldn't be 100% sure on that. But I think that has been the case. And if so, it makes it even more tragic that the family did, you know, recently just move back, and this has happened.
Yeah. Now, Gareth, the police did say in their statement, while it is possible that Donoghue's injuries were sustained as a result of a collision with a vehicle, we're working to establish exactly what happened, and we're keen to speak to witnesses.
Yeah. Now, apparently, you know, there's a lot of talk on the ground, but I think at the moment it's still an ongoing investigation, so there's not much, you know, that's been said at the minute. There would have been, I think, a few witnesses in there at a public street, so I think they're hoping, you know, that now they'll continue their investigation and hopefully find out what happened.
And did children witness this incident, Gareth?
I've not heard anything along them lines. I think he was waiting for his friends at the time of the accident, was what neighbours were saying. I think he was the only child in the street at the time, so I don't believe so, but I couldn't be sure on that now.
It's a terrible tragedy. Gareth Across and Karen Mullen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up to 20 past 10 on Highland Radio, and we're going to take a short break there. We'll be back in a couple of minutes' time. See you just after these.
Call Sean now on 074-91-25000.
Just wondering, Sean, is anything going to be done about Marble Hill and the parking? It's absolutely terrible. They're allowed to park in, well, the worst possible manner. And if something, God forbid, were to happen, how on earth would the guards or ambulance get there? It happens every year. What is going to be done? Okay, anybody want to flavour that with any more information? Give us a call. Let us know what's the problem in Marble Hill. And I presume you're talking about during summer periods, especially when it's busy, and it is busy and has been busy over recent days. And I'm sure it'll be busy today as well with that beautiful weather when people are sort of making the most of it and heading to those beautiful parts of Donegal. We talked about planning yesterday, just briefly. There were two people on at the end of the programme, and they were both talking about problems getting planning permission, and in both cases it was family land where they want their children to build in different areas of Donegal, and one was about 5 kilometres from Letterkenny, one was in Inishowen, and on both cases the planning had been, in both cases the planning had been turned down, and they were just saying it's so unfair. They say these weren't big extravagant houses, we can't understand why we've been turned down for planning permission. And this caller contacted us to say, my daughter has tried for planning on our land. Again, we're being told no. Why are they refusing so many people? And especially given that people are leaving the country, people have been emigrating, children have been emigrating, and these parents are trying to hang on to their children and, you know, keep them here. And that's what we'd all like to see, isn't it? But anyway, planning, we can certainly discuss it again today. It came up on the programme yesterday. This caller says, could you appeal to On Board Planella? As for blocking a view, we had a 4,000 square foot holiday home plunked in front of us and blocking our view, and they built it higher than they were supposed to. They use it for, at the most, 4 to 6 weeks in the year. It's a monstrosity. We had to jump through all the hoops for our house, but there was no holds barred when it came to this one. Okay, so there's another person not happy about planning at the moment. So there you go. We've got a conversation going here on planning since yesterday. So again, if you do have a view, bring it to us. Let us know. We'd like to hear from you on the programme. But let's move on now to another issue that's concerning people in rural areas in Ireland in particular. And it's a concern over GPs who are retiring and what's going to happen then. The lack of GPs in rural areas is going to be a big problem in Ireland unless something is done to arrest the situation. Now, Dr. Andy Jordan is chairman of the NAGP. And Dr. Jordan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thanks for joining us. Now, this issue has obviously arisen before. You know, the GPs are retiring and, you know, we can't get younger GPs to come necessarily into some of these areas. But why are we talking about it now? There's been a survey done on the subject.
Well, I suppose what highlighted, well, the reason we're talking about it today is because of the article in yesterday's Independent, where an independent journalist published figures on her research around the country, and there's some very surprising stats in that.
Were you surprised with them?
No. We, in fairness, in the NAGP, in the National Association of General Practitioners, we've been predicting this for the last 4 or 5 years, but certainly the last 4 years. Like, this all goes back to the FEMPI legislation. That's the Financial Emergency Measures in the Public Interest Act, which, when the financial crisis hit. So what happened was that we had 4 FEMPI cuts, which were applied to general practice and primary care. And the net result of those was that there was a 38% reduction in the flow of finances and funding into GP surgeries to provide money to supply services to patients. You must remember that a GP gets a tranche of money based on the practice size that he has. So it's a kind of, for want of a better word, a headage payment, and X amount of patients will attract so much money, and that money has been reduced. So you could say that the money is the patient's money that comes into the practice to supply services. The GP's portion of that is the profit that's left after supplying the service. 38% is what it all added up to. Of course, that's a catastrophic figure because the actual workload for the GPs has increased because more and more people have got cover with the state schemes, the over 70s, the under 6, and that has led to an increase in workload. So you have an increase in workload with a decrease in income stream coming in to supply the service.
Now, I noticed, and I'm sure you did, because I read that piece in the Irish Independent yesterday, and underneath the online contributions, you will have noticed maybe if you read some of the comments that people were making. And I was astounded by the negativity of people, given that we all appreciate our GPs and we all need them at one time or another. The vitriol toward GPs online, and I know you tend to get that with some of the online contributions, but, you know, talking about the wages and people, this perception there, they're all loaded.
But you see, the problem is that the majority of patients patients don't have any idea how general practice is funded. They think, they read a headline, like, for example, every year the HSE publishes figures of the earnings. They put it up there, the earnings of GPs.
And it will say, like, Dr. Andy Jordan, a million or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And people think, gosh, he's making a killing out of it.
But, I mean, of course, what they don't understand is that that's not what that's a figure at all. That's a figure that the practice is supplied to supply all the services, including the premises, everything from the front door in and all the services throughout the year, 24/7, which means that the GP is responsible for the out of hours and the funding of it as well. So I don't mind that. If people don't understand something, that's fine, and there's loads of people don't understand a lot of things about finance of various things. So, but I mean, I think we have to stay focused, and that is that we have a huge problem, and this problem is going to impact dreadfully over the next 5 to 10 years. And as like, you must remember that already, even up to now, we've had, like, some counties have been very badly affected. Take County Clare, for example, there where we ran the No Doctor, No Village campaign, where a number of practices had closed down because they weren't viable, and then nobody applied for the list then when they became vacant. So on the foot of that, Michael Harty from Kilmehill in Clare was elected as a TD. So we already have a kickback in some areas from the withdrawal of GP services. You have a lot of patients in other counties, particularly along the Western Seaboard, where, you know, people who might have had a GP service 5 miles up the road are now travelling 15, 20 miles to access the service. But as things deepen, and you saw the stats there yesterday on the age profile of GPs, unfortunately, GPs are getting older, and the younger GPs, now this is the kernel of the problem, the young GPs do not see Ireland now and Irish general practice as an attractive place to work. So we are training 180-odd GPs in the training scheme. This year, for the first time ever, we weren't able to fill the GP training places. So there's 10 empty places now in the programme this year. Now, these places would have been highly sought after, and there would have been, you know, 2-3 to 1 looking for the places, whereas now we can't fill them. But there's an even worse problem. That scheme, the training programme goes on for 4 years, and then at the end of the 4-year period, you're expecting that those graduates will then populate the areas where you have GPs retiring. Unfortunately now, because the general practice is in such a dreadful state, these qualified doctors are now leaving our shores, and up to 50% of the graduates are leaving and going to Australia, New Zealand, America.
But can we, you see, I know that's happening, but it's happening in other areas, of course, too, where, you know, other professions are saying, well, nurses and other professions, they're being attracted by, you know, travel and living in a different country where the sun shines and the wages are better. And that's going to happen. We have to live with that, don't we?
No. This is on a different scale. You must remember now that there's a change in the profile of, say, GP. First of all, we have another problem within the student, and that is student debt. So you have a lot of students now are postgrad students. So they have gone to secondary school, then gone and done a primary degree, and then gone back and done postgrad medicine. So the only medical school left that doesn't have postgrads is Trinity. All the other medical schools have postgrads. So surgeons and UL in Limerick is all postgrad, and the others have probably over 50% of their class now are postgrad. So those students are paying for their own education through the system. So they're coming out with student loans of between 100 and 200,000 euros. So they're carrying a debt for their education immediately when they qualify.
Yep. But, Doctor, is it not the case, if you look at, and I mentioned it before you come on, if we take a look at Letterkenny Hospital, for instance, where we have problems, you know, recruiting at all levels, because people want, doctors, consultants want to be in, you know, cities and maybe more university teaching hospitals and all of that, even though this is a university hospital, they want to be in the Galways and the Dublins and places like that. Isn't it the same with GPs? GPs, does the rural area appeal to them, or would they prefer to be in cities?
No, I think we're missing the point. The point is that this is a problem right across the health sector now. It's not, I mean, what you're saying is correct. Yes, those jobs in Dublin would be in normal times more attractive. But, I mean, Letterkenny is an attractive place to be. And if prior to the FEMPI, you must remember that the consultants also suffered from cuts from the FEMPI. if, and those of your listeners who would have been listening to the debate that went on a week or two ago, we have 150 odd consultants appointed to our hospitals who don't have the basic qualification to be a consultant. The HSE have admitted that. So we are now appointing people who are not on the specialist register even as consultants in our hospitals because there's no other applicant.
And are you saying they're not fit to do the job?
I'm saying exactly the situation. I'm saying that there's 400 empty posts and we got, as a, under a, an FOI, and not under a parlementary question, in the Dáil, where that information came out 2 weeks ago, that we have appointed people to consultant posts that haven't got the basic qualification. They're not on the register, the specialist register, for the positions they're appointed for. That's the situation in the hospital. In general practice, the situation is worse because we're losing our manpower. But look, if you don't have a strong primary care service, if you don't have strong general practice and so on, because general practice is what keeps people out of hospital. So you need a strong general practice to treat people in the community, near their homes. You need to be able to take care of people in nursing homes, near their homes. And if all that disintegrates, well then the patients are all going to end up in the hospital system. We have 560,000 people on waiting lists at the moment to be seen in either outpatient or waiting for surgery. These are catastrophic figures. Like, we're at the cliff edge here, right across health. Now, sure, we're talking about general practice, we're talking because of the article, but it's hospitals and it's general practice. But what we need to save general practice at the moment, we need a reversal of the FEMPI. Like, it's happening for public service workers. They're already starting the process of reversing FEMPI. But that's not happening for general practice. And we also need a new medical card contract, a GMS contract, that's fit for purpose, that'll make Ireland an attractive place for young doctors to come to. We need to retain our young, highly trained GPs and keep them here.
Okay, a caller says the medical practices should employ physician associates to assist doctors. The UK and the US have used physician associates successfully to address this problem.
Yeah, but you need funding to apply. Like, the point is, again, you're missing the
I'm missing a lot for you today, but
that point is raised is a reasonable point, and in fairness, has been looked at, but the thing is, that's a practice staff member who has to be paid. What I'm pointing out to you is GPs have to employ practice staff. They can decide whether a physician associate or a practice nurse or X amount of practice managers or secretaries that they need. So individual practices require different things. But for them to do that and practice best medicine, they need to have the resources to employ those people. And if they haven't got the money to employ them within their practice, well, then they can't employ them.
So how long do we have, do you think? I mean, you're saying we're on a cliff edge here.
We are in the sense that we already have practices around the country that have closed down. We have a TD in the Dáil who's been elected in Clare on the head of it already. We had a candidate in Mayo for that same election that didn't make it over the line, but that's a different issue. And I suppose we're probably looking at a similar situation around the country where perhaps we may have more candidates running on this issue. But I think it shouldn't come to that we should, like, people, the patients, like, what I'm finding out, that this is patients' money. This is money belonging to people with medical cards where their funding has been withdrawn. And because they don't understand the system, they think it's our money. It's actually not our money. It's their money for a service in their communities.
Okay, Dr. Andy Jordan, thank you for joining us. Thank you. It's the chairman of the NAGP there. That's Dr. Andy Jordan on this, it was an Irish Independent report yesterday. Concerns for rural patients in particular. Up to 50% of GPs around the country are planning to retire soon. Now, Donegal was mentioned. It wasn't the highest figure. I think it was around 25%, something like that in Donegal, according to this figure, but it was up to 40 and more, perhaps, in other areas, but pretty worrying even at that. Okay, we're going to take a little break, back in a wee while. Welcome back. It's 20 to 11. Now, this caller says, when you go to our doctors, this doctor's with a certain complaint, you're not allowed to talk about another complaint. I took somebody with swollen legs, and he then said, would you take a look at the rash on my arms? And the doctor said, come back another day with the rash. You told me about the legs. I only look at one problem. Ooh. That's a bit... Is that odd? I think it's a bit strange. I never heard of that happening before, but if that's happening, maybe it's a policy in the doctors, I don't know. Seems a bit strange to me. You could have a couple of complaints that could be related to the one complaint. But anyway, it's a bit strange. Maybe the doctor was having a bad day. Keep the calls and comments coming anyway on 0749125000. The Cabinet has endorsed changes to drink driving laws, which would see those detected over the blood alcohol limit being automatically disqualified. Now, this is something, as you know, that Minister Shane Ross has been pushing. And let's talk to Niall O'Connor, political correspondent with the Irish Independent. Niall, good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
Now, if he's been pushing it, a certain Healy Ray has been pushing the other way on this one. Who's won?
Well, by the way, I should say to people, a lot of people don't know in relation to Danny Healy Ray, he doesn't actually drink, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Given that he is, he has said this week that he'd have no problem getting in the back of a car with someone who's had 3 points. This is a big, big issue in Leinster House this week, Sean. Now, going back to...
Now, they're big publicans, aren't they, I suppose? That
yeah, they are big publicans. Yeah, yeah. So, oh, no, absolutely, and yeah. as is Michael. Now, and he also know that there's a lot of a big rural vote down in Kerry. But going back to yesterday's Cabinet meeting, I suppose people were expecting a bit of a standoff between Shane Ross and members of Fine Gael, because members of Fine Gael have been very strong, particularly rural members, that they're worried about introducing any measures that would be over the top, and some believe that Shane Ross's proposal is over the top. So what it effectively means is that anyone found having consumed between 50 and 80 milligrams per 100 litres, now what that actually means is about, you know, around a pint, maybe a little bit more, a glass of wine, you know, one unit, that they could potentially be put off the road for 3 months. So really, what does it mean here? What does Shane Ross want to do? He wants to introduce a law that means if you have any alcohol, if you have any drop whatsoever, you will be put off the road for 3 months instead of, say, being slapped with two penalty points. But at yesterday's Cabinet meeting, a number of ministers, including your own Joe McHugh up in Donegal, expressed serious concern about Shane Ross's proposals. Having said that, whatever transpired at Cabinet, Leo Varadkar managed to ensure he managed to calm the waters, and he managed to actually ensure that Fine Gael Cabinet members rode in behind Shane Ross's bill. So as of now, the Cabinet is behind Shane Ross's bill. But what we're going to see now is perhaps new politics. It wouldn't have happened under Enda Kenny, I don't believe, and that is Leo Varadkar is going to go to his parliamentary party in September. And if his parliamentary party kick up enough of a fuss to say that they do not agree with this clampdown on drink driving, then he may be obliged to offer a free vote. Now, I'm told that Fine Gael are split down the middle. It's a rural-urban divide. So if you had a situation whereby there is a free vote in the Dáil on this set of proposals, you would have Fianna Fáil voting against it, you would have half of Fine Gael potentially voting against it, and you would have a scenario whereby the measures probably would fall, the Dáil would vote them down, but Cabinet would be in favour of the measures. So effectively, Leo Varadkar would be on the wrong side of the vote, and all his Cabinet members, even the ones who are concerned about these proposals, would be on the wrong side of the vote. So in terms of, you know, how it's playing out in terms of arithmetic and the way the sort of freedom that Leo Varadkar is potentially given his own TDs on this issue, it's quite intriguing, and it is in some ways new politics. He did say recently he does want to see more free votes on particular issues. This is a very, very sensitive issue. It's a very, very controversial and emotional issue, Sean. But if Leo Varadkar starts allowing free votes on issues that aren't relating to finance, that aren't relating to the issues of conscience like abortion, then he's going to face demands left, right and centre for free votes into the future. So what's going to happen now? Well, I think at tonight's parliamentary party meeting, it's the last parliamentary party meeting before the summer recess, by the way, Sean, I think Leo Varadkar is going to try and calm the waters, and he's going to say, well, look, let's consider this issue over the summer, and let's not reach any rash judgments. But it is a very, very difficult one for the Taoiseach, and if he does lose this issue at the parliamentary party meeting in September, then that will be undermining and it will be damaging for his leadership just a few months into his tenure.
Yeah, well, you mentioned, I mean, for instance, Joe McHugh, who questioned the logic in what's happening here. Whilst in no way is he supporting drink driving, that there are TDs who are questioning this particular measure, and they're talking about, well, what about people the next morning, you know, when they're getting up after a night, are they going to be banned for 3 months or whatever? And they weren't out drinking, they just had drink from the night before, and they may have been slightly over because of that. That's the type of person. Now, this is a really, really difficult debate, isn't it? Because a TD doesn't want to come on and say, I support drink driving, but on the other hand, they have constituents saying, oh, this is too far.
Yeah, and on one side, then you also have, road campaigners who have lost loved ones because someone got behind a wheel and decided to drink and drive and were over the limit. And so that's why there is a real emotive element to it. And then you have the example, and you gave a good example there. And for example, the people who would live in rural Donegal who may only go out for a drink on a Friday or Saturday night, they could be elderly, they could be isolated. And, this is their only opportunity to actually to meet people and to have a couple of pints. And then are they going to, now go home at night worried about getting up the next morning, getting behind the wheel and driving to see their loved one, or driving to mass even? Are they going to now stop going out on the Friday night for fear that they will be found to have consumed this new limit, this between 50 and 80 mg that Jane Ross wants to introduce? And you can't have a scenario, I don't think, whereby not only there's measures that are going to kill off the rural pub, but you can't have a scenario whereby we're going to introduce measures that could diminish what rural Ireland is all about. Rural Ireland is really struggling, and rural Ireland already believes that they're not listened to inside the four walls that I'm in here in Kildare Street in Leinster House. So an interesting element there last night, and it was being spun to us, I think, from the Fine Gael side, Sean, that is that Shane Ross is now going to be, he's been told effectively, although he claims that he offered to do this, and that is to go down the country and meet some of the rural publicans and see can they come up with some form of compromise whereby the government could potentially incentivise pubs who would ferry customers to and from their pubs, their locals, their regulars who have been there for years on a Friday or a Saturday night to deal with the issue of drink driving and to ensure that they don't have to get behind the car. Now, that's not going to sort out the dilemma that you spelled out and you articulated there, which is people getting up the next morning. But it might be some potential solution to the huge rural-urban divide that we have here. Now, having said that, the critics of Shane Ross would say, there's a phrase going around Leinster House, but sure, Shane Ross doesn't know what rural Ireland looks like. He doesn't know what it looks like to go outside of Dublin. That's what critics say of him. That is unfair. But then again, he is certainly a very, very Dublin-centric minister. He does need to sit down with the publicans. He does need to sit down with the vintners. He does need to sit down with the rural groups, because the last thing the government wants and the last thing Leo Varadkar wants is for this to explode into a big rural-urban divide when they come back in September. It is, as you say, a hugely, hugely divisive issue. So while Shane Ross has got a bit of a victory because this has got through Cabinet, at least 7 or 8 Fine Gael TDs have said to me in the last hour, walking the corridors in Leinster House before I'm speaking to you, that they're very, very much opposed to these measures. So what is the solution? Well, maybe the solution can be found in the Fianna Fáil proposal, which is, instead of introduce a write-out ban, just increase the severity of the penalty. So what Fianna Fáil want to do for people who are found to have consumed this particular amount of alcohol, who are found to have this particular amount of alcohol in their blood, is that you would be given 5 instead of 2 penalty points, and you would be slapped with a €500 fine. Maybe that's the middle ground solution, but certainly all eyes are on what goes on in Fine Gael and whether or not Leo Varadkar can prevent any form of standoff with his own parliamentary party. And September is going to be a very, very busy month, Sean. I mean, we're going to have the budget, we're going to have the prospect of you know, dealing with water charges and water refunds, which, by the way, despite the fact that this deal on water was done months ago, it's still not through the House. There's 2 days left now in the Dáil. They're sitting for the rest of today, then they're sitting on Thursday and Friday, then there'll be the summer recess. So this issue might be dealt with, although it might surface next week, by the way. A lot of us in Dublin coming up to Glenties next week, yeah. For that particular summer school. But I think Leo Varadkar just wants this drink driving issue he wants to calm the waters tonight, but it is certainly going to re-emerge now when the summer recess is over.
Okay, Niall, thanks for joining us.
Just to say to you, this is probably, I can just say on behalf of everyone here in Leinster House, we were very sad to see you leave, and I know Friday is your last day, and you know, we've had great crack over the years talking to you, although you're more than able to ask the very, very hard questions of us political correspondents, so thanks for that, and very best of luck to you.
Well, I appreciate that. Enjoy Donegal now. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Bye. Niall O'Connor there, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, and we will be back after these. Hey, how that news was read, but it was read like never ever before. That's fair to say.
But you'd be amazed what's happened in this place over the years now, Sean.
That's a first, though, isn't it?
I believe so, but yeah.
More to be explained later.
We are an important presence.
Yes.
And are acting accordingly.
Exactly.
Thank you, Donald.
Yeah, Donald, thanks very much. And in watching you read in the news, and not a bit of nerves in it for Donald, being what he's used to performing on stage, you see, we have the former councillor and senator, Jimmy Hart, along with his wife, Mary, with us today. It's great to see you. Good
Thank
morning.
You, Sean.
Good morning.
Very thrilled to be here.
Thrilled to have you. And I suppose there was a time, Mary, first of all, I must say to you that we wondered, would we ever be talking to Jimmy on the radio again? Absolutely. Would you be talking to him again?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just amazing what a couple of years has done, how somebody can just come from no voice, no mobility, no voice, no swallow, all of that, and today eating, laughing, walking, you know, it's miraculous, really. Yeah, I have to say.
And no hope at one time, probably.
No. Well, there were a few very hairy moments, put it like that, where we would have been, you know, the family would have been called, and we just didn't know would he make it. But he did. He battled. But my thoughts are also with those that didn't make it, and those that I know of. And particularly the McFeely family today, who are struggling with what we were struggling with back then. And I just want them to know that they're in our thoughts today.
Well, okay. That's nice and lovely to hear you say that. Jimmy, this all began, this journey, on the 16th of November 2013. Mm. You were found unconscious on Newmarket Square in Dublin. I wouldn't expect that you remember anything about that, do you?
I remember nothing at all about it. I was at a soccer match, Ireland playing
Latvia,
I think it was, in Land's End Road, and I met Paul McGrath after it and had a photograph with him, and great time, but my memory of it is nothing. I remember waking up in the hospital in Dublin, wondering where I was or what I was doing, but it was a frightening experience, but thank God I've been through it and I've come out the other end with my life intact, and my friends are still there. And I want to thank the nurses and the hospitals and all the fantastic work they've done. You know, people give out about doctors and nurses, but I couldn't say one bad word about them. They were excellent, you know, they're brilliant.
Well, Jimmy, we were so shocked and saddened when we heard about it, and it was obviously a big story nationally, you know, that you'd been found unconscious on this street in Dublin after the football match, and people didn't know what the heck to think. They worried, had you been attacked and all that at the time. Of course, it transpired that wasn't the case, but they were the initial worries, weren't they?
I don't think we'll probably ever know what the truth is, but we definitely ruled out the attack because there was CCTV footage that kind of ruled that out. He fell. He literally fell. And he was within about 100 yards of the apartment, his own apartment. He was near there. Now, it isn't probably not the best lit area. And cobbled, you know yourself, cobbled stones that are broken. And God knows. We'll probably never know.
Do you remember the first call you got?
Like? I do indeed. It wasn't a call at all. It was the doorbell went in the middle of the night. And there was two guards standing at my door. And I knew it wasn't good when you see two guards standing at your door in the middle of the night. You know,
you normally think of kids, don't you?
So they said there's been an accident and we need you to come to Dublin, really. Or there's somebody in hospital in Dublin. I thought, well, there's only two in Dublin. That's Jimmy and Amy. So one of the two. I said, male or female? They said, male. So I said, okay, come in. The two guys come in and they said, you have to ring the hospital immediately to talk to them, you know, the emergency services. They said, it's pretty bad. So I literally ran upstairs. I said, no, I won't ring them yet. And I just ran up and I got Jimmy's list of, he was on some medication anyway because he did stents. And I thought, I better get the list so that they're not giving him stuff that'll react with that. I don't know where I got the presence of mind. Just to think about what you do in an emergency. So I came back down with the list of meds and rang the hospital in, but I knew it was pretty, pretty bad. And I knew on the voice on the other end that it was bad, so I immediately rang then Amy and her partner Jim, who are now getting married in February of this year. And I said, just get Amy in immediately to somebody. I didn't even know at that stage, was it to identify him or whether, you know, and I think now she was given a much more a grim reading than I had been given. Even when she arrived in the hospital, she got a terrible shock. But he survived. He's a survivor.
For you, I mean, I've known you for a long time. And, I mean, I can still hear just going through that. Mm. It's kind of, I don't want you to relive a nightmare, but in order to tell us what happened, it is reliving a nightmare, isn't it?
Well, it is, absolutely. I mean, it's traumatic. There's no other way. It's a trauma. And you deal with that. Do you know, I don't know how I dealt with it. You know, when you have four children looking at you and willing their daddy to live, you know, you just have to find a way. You have to find a way through it. And it's minute by minute, day by day. You cannot think long term. You just have to think, I have to get through today. And every day, and then it was a month, and then it was a year, and now it's, you know, a couple of years later. And that's how we did it. But we were blessed. We had a sense of humour as well. So the humour in the middle of all, sometimes in horrible situations like that, there you do find humorous moments,
and
that keeps your sanity. Oh, wonderful, wonderful children! Oh, blessed. The youngest just got married last week, Lachlan. Yeah, so we had a lovely family occasion. No, the youngest boy, and Lachlan to Emer Gibbons, a local girl, Mickey Gibbons' daughter, and peculiarly, she's a doctor in Beaumont now. She's just finished her studies and is back in Beaumont.
Is it a grace in a way, Jimmy, that you don't remember a lot of?
I think it is, yeah. I think when I woke up in National Rehab Hospital, I didn't know where I was and what happened. And people told me what happened and I still couldn't recall it. Mm-hmm. And I remember things before the accident that I've forgotten. Mm. You know, people who died and I didn't know because it did left my memory, but it was a frightening experience, but thank God I came out of it all right.
What's the journey been like since then, trying to put your life together again?
Well, I've given up the business and I'm, I suppose, retired, like my good wife here. We're looking forward to having a swan song now of, you know, fun and frolics, but at the time, it was frightening now because I woke up morning thinking this is the last day, you know, forget about it and move on. But only for my family and my wife, I would have maybe been worse off. But, you know, thank God for them. You know, they came through tough times. You know, I didn't know how tough it was until I heard about it afterwards. But thank God it worked out all right.
And I mean, and to try and put into words the struggle, you know, from going from that to this today and, you know, getting to almost learn to walk again, all of those things. Yeah. I mean, this you've come through the most incredible journey. Is that painful?
At the time it wasn't, no, but looking back on it, I was struggling with mobility and getting around the place and being able to talk. I couldn't... I remember one time the doctor came into Mary, or the Mary came into the nurses, and they said, any talk today? Oh, no, he's not talking. What do you ask him? What's his name and where's he from and what does he do? No reply. And she said, hold on a second. She started to say these town lads are in Glencombe Kill. Mary did. Crywow, Lee McGowra, Teelan. I kept repeating them. I just repeat them after she said it because that area don't think all mean so much to me.
Yeah.
But it brought it out to me, but the work the nurses did was amazing, you know.
Do you remember that?
I don't know.
No. But do you remember being in a place like where people were trying to communicate to you and you couldn't communicate back?
Yes. I can remember a time where I was just too distraught to answer, you know, and that this is it, just go now and leave people peace, you know. But thank God I got... I remember one particular day I woke up and I said, this is it, it's over now, you know, I'm quite happy to go. And I fell asleep and woke up the next day and says, Christ, I'm back again, you know. So that was the first day that I really felt recovery starting, you know.
Yeah, that's great to hear that.
I think then there were very funny moments in the middle of it, you know, where I mean, I know my sister Deirdre at one stage, and she was in, it was here in Letterkenny actually, and he wasn't really speaking very much at that stage, and she spotted Father McHugh, big Father McHugh, and she said, Father, you wouldn't come in and just maybe give Jimmy a blessing or something, you know. And Jimmy hadn't been speaking, he was lying very quiet, and there wasn't much chatter, really, he wasn't capable of much. But when he came in, he went to the car, and Deirdre then panicked because she thought he was giving him the last rites, and she thought, oh no, I just wanted you to give him a blessing. And when he went to give Jimmy the blessing, she said, Jimmy just opened his eyes and he says, Christ, I thought it was Callan Deegan from before.
that was even to be speaking again.
Yeah.
We just went, so
and
strange.
I think Father McHugh got a bigger fright than we got.
Yeah. I knew Father McHugh when we were at school. He was in Milford, now he's Letterkenny. He's a good soccer player and he's a big lad, like big heavy guy, and he went into the priesthood then, and he's, where's he now? Kerry Keel or somewhere like that, you know.
Well, Jimmy, we all, of course, I mean, we had many conversation on here over the years, usually 90% about politics, and not always, because we talked about your marathon running as
Right,
I remember you starting that, and I remember you saying to me at the time, I still remember that conversation came about, because you said you were on a holiday on the beach, and it was Mary who said to you, you need to do some running or something, or as a joke, and then you took it seriously, and you actually started the marathons.
I did 9 or 10.
A bit of bet on with you.
That was another amazing turnaround in your life.
It was.
And you were really into that fitness.
I loved it now, really. You know.
And I just wonder now, did that stand up to you? I know you had heart problems after that, didn't you? But did that stand up?
I think it did. It helped me discipline myself and get back in the game and sort of not lie around, you know, so
And I mean, it takes such an effort, you know, to take such a so short walk even, you know, but I suppose for me, I remember the that would have been some of the most difficult moments for me, I have to say, when I saw them running on the roads locally, and he wasn't running, and that I would have found difficult, probably one of the most difficult things. But I mean, he's swimming today, you know, he's back swimming now in short walks, and we'll get there.
I mean, your positivity, despite I mean, you were probably listening to a lot of people saying, you know, oh, Mary, you know, don't be hoping for too much, and all of that you hear, you know, and you know that Jimmy's not going to be the Jimmy was, and all those things that people will say to you, because that's what they think. And you throughout, because I spoke to you obviously on the radio whilst Jimmy has been recovering, and you throughout have been determined. I just wonder, I mean, Jimmy, how much of it has been Mary's determination as well?
Oh, definitely. It's a big help now. She knew what buttons to press and and what to say and what to do, and it was amazing what she did, you know.
Yeah.
And she sorted out the whole business you know, from someone who wasn't involved in it, you know, when I sold it.
Yeah, I mean, there were simple things, like, I suppose maybe it's because you know somebody maybe quite well, but, I mean, I remember one particular, it was a toileting issue in one of, I'm not going to say what hospital it was very good, a really, really good hospital, but I remember there was a meeting then, you know, like a medical meeting, and they said, the toileting, no, that's not going to work, and I said, but how could it? There's three people standing looking at you when you're trying to toilet, you know, that's not, there's no dignity in that. Above all issues, toileting, do you know? So I said, we need to rethink about how maybe we're doing it, do you know? And sure, it's grand, perfect. But I mean, if you didn't have a voice, and I was lucky I had a voice, and Anne Hart, Jimmy's sister, was the voice with me. And if I didn't have that voice, there are many people that probably would take at face value what you're told, and you have to trust, you know, what you've been told. And on the whole, what we were being told was absolutely correct. But there were some issues, and yeah, does it need challenging? Absolutely.
Yeah, and the fact, I think your background helped.
Yeah.
Your work background, because I mean, you've been in the business of helping people in recovery.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I suppose didn't take no for an answer all the time. you always had to find another way to get people to move from A to B.
But that issue you mentioned, the toileting, you know, and they're saying, well, it'll take three. He's not going. It's not going to work. This, and you're saying, well, if people are standing watching him, would you go easily?
Exactly. I couldn't.
And and now that, obviously, that isn't an issue, but it could have been. It would have been.
It could be,
Jimmy, you were a very active politician and vocal politician. And we had many's, thank God for you, because we had many's a great debate and banter between you coming on and really kicking up a fuss on this show over the years. And I mean, we had great radio, I have to say, with you. And you rose to senator. I mean, you come from a very political background with your dad, Paddy, of course. And, you know, he's been there, obviously, and still is, with your lovely mum. But, and your family, your brothers and sisters. But Jimmy, what about that political background? Like, how much of that now matters to you?
Not a lot, really. You know, it's a memory for me, but I have no intention to come back into it at all. It doesn't excite me at all now. You know, let people get on with it and do what they have to do. But I'm quite happy now with my wife. We're going into retirement. We'll enjoy the holidays and the evenings out and the kids.
Do you have much memory of it?
Of which?
Politics.
I do, yeah. But funny, the Senate, I don't have much memories of. I don't know why. I can remember being there, but I don't remember rooms or office that I was in, you know. I don't know why it blocked out, you know. But I don't miss it, no.
It's interesting, isn't it?
He'd still be in contact now with some of them, you know. Yes. They were friends. But he wouldn't have a great recollection of the office even that he was in. That shocked me, because I kept saying, we need to go back in. Just to put closure and things, but it wouldn't be the same because the people that were with him are gone now anyway, do you know what I mean? So he wasn't really interested in doing that, so I had to listen to his voice, and he was saying, I'm not really interested. Didn't have a huge memory of it, but maybe just on those conversations that you and Jimmy had, Sean, I personally, I know, and I know Jimmy certainly would like to thank you for your service to all of us and my family over the years. And I have to say, I mean, you were, you know, you reflected the eyes and ears of Donegal. And for that, we'll be eternally grateful. And you supported us in our hour of need. And for that, I personally am very, very grateful for that. And I think your professionalism has always shone through. And your compassion has shone through. And I suppose if you had to pick one word, it was that sense of compassion. And to reflect back professionally and objectively what people were feeling and what they were thinking. And that's a skill. And we will miss you sorely.
Oh, well, thanks very much. I'm going to get back to you now because there's a good few calls coming in as well. The Sweeney family just want to say We wish Jimmy all the best. Mm. Kathleen Barnett, wish Jimmy all the best. And Mary, and great to hear you so well, Jimmy. Neil Sweeney, who was in the bed beside you in the rehab, and can only praise the good work of the staff who have helped both of us get our lives back on track.
Absolutely. Totally, immeasurable.
Help in the hospital was phenomenal. Absolutely.
You remember that?
I do. I remember nurses coming round, and I had carers. Which all came out cares, yeah. came out of the house afterwards and came in every day to Ruth's garden and
Teresa
and
Lisa.
And Lisa.
Lovely Lisa.
Lovely girls. And
there were more. There was Brendan.
Yeah.
There's Francis.
Every 7 days
Vanessa
a week.
And Tracy.
They would call out of the house, spent the day with me and put me through exercises and
fabulous.
Kept me spirits up, you know. I never heard of these carers before I end up in the hospital, but they're doing a phenomenal job, you know.
How do you, or how did you, do you deal with the frustration that comes from having that big memory gap in your life, and maybe somebody saying to you, "Oh, that person died. Did you not know
that?" Well, funny, I have issues with people who died. I would say to Mary, "Is that man living or dead?" I just have no memory, you know, and people who had died and.
Forgotten
I'd been at funerals and forgotten about them, you know. But I have to say now and again, is that person living or dead?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, that's the condition, isn't it? Nice to hear Jimmy again, and wish him all the best from the Friel family of Port Hall. And to Eunan and Hannah Duffy, they've called in to say delighted to hear Jimmy today.
I know Eunan.
And Molly Callan says the hearts are made out of hard stuff. Wishing him there and all the family all the best.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
All the staff at Medical Rehab Letterkenny are delighted to hear Jimmy on the radio. It's fantastic.
Only if them wouldn't be here today. They brought me through tough times, and I'm delighted for them.
Yeah, I don't think you maybe appreciate how much it means to people to be hearing you talking today on the radio. And
I hope it gives them a bit of hope themselves if they're feeling down. You know, you always feel down time to time. But if someone's feeling down, just remember you'll be up again tomorrow and keep at it. And that's how I look at life now. You know, there's good days and bad days, but the good days always come through.
And it's a good job in a way that you're not hankering to be back where you were in that Senate. You know, imagine if you had that, couldn't let go of that.
I'm well away from it now.
Yeah, I was shocked at that, to be honest with you, Sean, because I thought it was so deeply ingrained in him. I thought the politics was so deeply ingrained in their family anyway that I thought he is going to have great difficulty moving away from this. I was shocked at how easily at how easy it was
for
him.
Good family around me.
It's not to say that he's not political and isn't interested and reads his papers every single day and, you know, the news and is familiar with what's going on. But it was the ease with which he stepped back from it shocked me. And then, I mean, it is a big change. Like, even when you leave politics all of a sudden, you know, the invitations stop. You know, we had an invitation in yesterday to a wedding, Vanessa Orr's wedding, and I said, isn't that lovely? I think that's the first invitation we've had in 4 years.
Okay, let's deal with that. Because people, they don't know how to handle this.
Absolutely.
Like, this is such a different situation. From Mary and Jimmy being invited to all the do's in town because, you know, of who you are and all of that, let's be honest about it.
Yeah. Mm.
Then suddenly people think, how do we handle this? Mm. Now, does that hurt?
No, but I think, I always remember, funny, it was either Mary Coughlin or Celia Keaveney or maybe both. And I always remember them saying that to me, how within 24 hours, having lost an election, that everything shut down. Do you know, there was no more phone calls, there was no more, you know, best wishes or, you know, that all that circle shut down pretty quickly. So, you know, I suppose we've won a few elections, we lost a few, so I kind of was used to that. Do you know what I mean? But I kind of just knew it was part of the, it comes with the territory, do you know what I mean? Even though he loved it when he was in it, I was surprised he was able to move back with the ease with which he moved back. But yeah, you do have to, you just find other ways. You're just going through different phases of your life. And this is a wonderful phase now that we're really excited about. You know, we're both going to be free now just to enjoy.
You're retiring this week as well?
Well, I have handed in my retirement notice now. It's not quite exhausted, but I have leave to take, so I'm effectively, retired.
And how does that feel?
Great. I loved it. I absolutely loved the work I was doing, I'm not going to lie. But there was days I looked at Jimmy and I thought, oh, I need to spend the time. And I couldn't do it as much as I wanted to, because I still had a whole lot of things, you know, I needed to sort out. Finances, business, politics, all of that had to be tidied up. And I needed to work as well to keep the wolf from the door. So, and, you know, I have children that are still, you know, Sive's still going to the convent at that age. So once that's done, I thought, okay, I've put closure in all of that now. I need to find time for me as well. Mm. So that's what we're going to do.
We had a strange time because when we got married, we had three children, nearly 3 years, you know, and that was it. And then we'd known for 19 years. Mary came into the house.
Then Sive came to haunt us.
Mary's come into the house saying, oh, I don't feel well, and this and that. And that's, go to the doctor. She went to the doctor and then came back. I said, what did they say? He says, I'm pregnant. I nearly died.
Yeah, but do you know what? She was meant to be here. Yeah. Because there were days when he was just a hair's breadth between life and death. Mm. And when I roared in his ear about Sive, and I said, she's at the school gate, you have to pick her up, Jim, please. Mm. I can't pick her up today. And you have to move your toe. He was moving nothing. And the toe started to move, and I thought, he hears. Mm. And Sive meant something.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, children are a wonderful asset. Mm. They are sent to test you, but they're a wonderful asset as well.
When there's a big gap, and I know this from some very close friends of mine, like yourselves, who've had a child with a big gap, and, you know, it's like grandchildren are different, you know, because
you can give them back.
There's something. Well, it's a wee bit different. You can't give yours back, but there's because you'd had the experience and the time. How special was it having Sive?
Oh my God, it was brilliant. It just lit up our lives, and it lit up our family home, and she still continues to light up our home. And it's lovely now because all of a sudden we have a new daughter now. Emer Gibbons has joined the flock now, and Amy's getting married, so we've Jim McGrath now, another son-in-law to be, and Michael's making ships once again.
Right.
So we shall see.
Yeah.
But, you know, before you know it then, I mean, what I find then with children now is that, well, Jimmy and I were only 22, 23 youngsters, same age as my mother when we got married. But the children are getting married at 34 and 35. So then the girls particularly are... they're under pressure that we weren't under at that age, really, you know, to have babies pretty quickly after they get married. Do you know what I mean? So before you know it, you know, you have grandchildren on the way. You don't have that, you know, there isn't a lull there anymore. So we'll have to prepare for that. But we're gonna live before that happens.
What are you looking forward to doing most, Jimmy, now then?
Just taking breaks and going away for a weekend and going away for a week and taking the kids on holiday. You know, it's a different phase of life, so it's lovely, it's great, you know, and I have a good wife to look after me. which is a godsend, you know. I know I'm looking forward to it, and I really look at the future with hope and not prosperity, but hope and
love.
Yes.
Mm. And you've obviously got great peace now as well.
Oh, definitely.
Which, you know, you would have been devoid of for a long time, Mary, because you were watching Jimmy when Jimmy would have been unaware.
Yeah.
Obviously, because he was unconscious for a lot of this time. And then, you know, you were trying to deal with it all. Yeah. I mean, it's been incredible.
The one thing I did learn, I remember, you know, during my own profession was, and it was a hard lesson to learn when I worked in mental health, was, you know, you have to know when to let go as well. You know, you intervene when it's necessary, but to be able to step back when you're no longer required. And there's learning in that for me with Jimmy, that I need to step back because you are conscious, and I'm probably on a higher level of consciousness than other people about him.
Well, you're conscious, not for yourself, it's for other people, and that's what you need to step back from, isn't it?
Exactly.
You know what you're saying? Yeah. Would you please thank Jimmy and Mary for all the work they did for me, local artist Ed, and all the best in your retirement well.
Thank you.
Delighted to hear Jimmy on your show. He was always a gentleman, is a gentleman. Best wishes, the Milligan family of Rafoe.
All right. Yeah.
Carol Ann McIntyre in Glencolumbkill. Wish Jimmy well.
Carol Ann, thank you.
Jimmy, a great man to us. When we met him in Dublin, when we were on a visit to the Doyle, he was, it was the day of his mum's birthday, from Eileen Farley and all in the Active Retirement Club.
Yeah.
Tell Mary, now is her chance to teach Jimmy to dance.
Okay. I don't think that's ever possible.
Okay.
Nothing to do with the accident.
go, Jimmy and Mary Hart. Amazing couple and much loved by all the extended family. Three big kisses on that. Oh. David Alcorn, former councillor and former colleague, yeah, and long-time friend. Great to hear him back on the radio.
Oh, that's lovely, you know, David.
Yeah, want to wish him and Mary and the family all the best for the future. He's a great man, David. Best wishes to Jimmy. Great to hear you on today. Listening in from Sunny Strand Hill from Kevin McFeely. Oh. Harry and Rosaline Gillen in Maville wish Jimmy well. Sean, well done to Jimmy. Good luck and good health. PJ Blake.
Good, nice.
Great to hear you sounding so well, Jimmy. All the best for the future from the Boggs family in Mallin Town. Oh. Kathleen and Michael Brown in Dunmore and Carrigans want to wish Jimmy well. Delighted you're doing so well. Michael was in the bed beside him in hospital.
That's right.
And all the best from the Conlon family in Rafoe. Jimmy, you are a marathon man in every sense, from Patsy McGonigal.
Oh, thank you, Patsy. Thank you.
And he knows a bit about marathons.
He definitely does.
He does. All the best from Thomas Gallagher in Ballybofey. Debbie, Declan Reynolds on Facebook wishing you well. Brilliant to hear Jimmy on the radio again. All the best for the future, Jimmy.
Good friend of mine.
Yeah. Listening in London, listening to my beautiful brother and his fantastic wife, even though I'm very aware of his recovery, it's brought tears to my eyes as listening to his voice with such clarity is still so emotional, from Ethna Hart.
Mrs. Trier, she's a nurse in London.
Yeah. That is
lovely.
Thank you.
Jimmy's life was saved once before. Was that right? Was there another issue? Did you ever have another incident? No?
I've plenty of them.
Yeah. All the best from the Connaughton and Galvin families in Strabane. And here's another one that says, Bernie Mullen on Facebook, so delighted to hear you sounding like your old self, Jimmy, and your wonderful wife, Mary, at your side through it all. The hearts are definitely made of strong stuff. And best wishes to Jimmy. Great to hear you on today. And now, yeah, we've done the dancing bit, haven't we? People are just so happy to hear and hear your voice. They hear the old Jimmy. That's what they're hearing back.
I'm glad to be back. And you know, it's great to be able to come up here. And,
absolutely.
And your final week, which we all will miss you, Sean. Yes. You know, you think, oh, you just move on. But people can move on from somebody who's as popular as you, you know.
Well, do you know, it's been, when I heard that you were going to come on, I was so chuffed in my last few days because your man has been a constant throughout, you know, and I was so sad when I heard what happened to you, and everybody was, and shocked and worried. And then I met you a couple of times, and I saw you, and you were so much better than perhaps anyone had expected at that point, and today, even better again.
You know, that's a small incremental step.
Small steps.
Absolutely. You know, I'll go back to the hospital that I attended, and the nurses and support staff brought me through, and I want to really thank them, you know, that I wouldn't give out about the health service again. Never again. The phenomenal work, you know.
Yeah.
And they're very good.
Well, anyway, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity, Sean.
And good luck in your future work, wherever it is.
Thanks, Jimmy.
I
appreciate it. And by the way, I wish you both every happiness, good health to enjoy this lovely retirement.
Yes,
and
you
too. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you.
Okay. That's Jimmy and Mary Hart. We'll be back after this break. We'll see you in a couple of minutes. And welcome back, and still a lot more people calling in to wish Jimmy well, and Mary, of course, and retirement now, but just so lovely to hear him on the radio, and it is a miracle, really. Emma McMullen, by the way, the Hearts wanted me to say a very happy birthday, especially for you, Emma, as well. From all the Ruddies to Jimmy, and Dan the Postman, who says, nice to hear Jimmy on the radio, miss you over in the city, and all the best to Jimmy and Mary, they've helped me out when I was in a pickle, and that's from Owen as well. So there you go. Good good stories coming in. Okay, Frank Larkin. I mentioned Frank earlier on in the programme, and he is going to be protesting tomorrow outside Leinster House from 12 until 4 p.m. He's a disability activist, of course. And Frank, hello to you.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
I'm very well, Frank. Now, you have been a voice for people who have a disability for many years, and you feel at this stage, because I've been reading some of your posts, probably as frustrated as ever. And tell us why.
Well, Sean, as you say, I've been for many years. And I was just thinking, actually, that the first time that I spoke with you on Highland Radio was just before Christmas in 1992.
Yeah.
One of the issues that, the issue that I was on about then was about being refused onto public transport because it wasn't accessible. That's still an issue that remains today. But the big frustration really for me is the fact that it's 3,757 days since Ireland signed the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, and yet today we still have no ratification.
So that begs the question, what's the point in signing up to it if you're not going to enact its recommendations?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we at the minute, we are the only remaining EU country who have not ratified the convention. And, you know, people often ask me why do you think this is the case or whatever. It's very simple. As far as I can work out, Sean, the political will simply is not there. The government will tell you that, you know, there's legislative issues to be sorted in order for ratification to proceed. But, I mean, surely that doesn't take nearly 4,000 days to get those legal issues ironed out.
When you say there's no political will, Frank, there wouldn't be a politician, I'm certain of this, that you have met who has said they wouldn't support you to your face anyway.
Absolutely, totally agree, John. But, I mean, do you believe that it takes, as I say, almost 4,000 days to iron out the legal issues in order to ensure that this convention comes into being in our country?
And that's over 10 years, obviously.
It's over four governments. We've had four Taoiseachs since we signed this convention.
Now, what would it mean in effect? Like, what would it mean on a daily basis for people with disabilities if this was signed? Ratified.
The convention, I mean, there's so much in it, John, but I mean, you know, just to give you a couple of examples, the right to personal assistance services. I'm going to Dublin tomorrow, this evening. I'll be going on public transport. I'll need two people to help me onto the bus. If the convention was properly enacted, that wouldn't be the case. I would have a right to be able to use accessible public transport. You know, the right to live in a place of your own, you know, a place that's suitable for you, suitable accommodation for living, basically. There's so many articles, Sean, you know. The big one, I suppose, is Article 19, the right to independent living.
And what, like, right to independent living? We've just been talking to Jimmy, and, you know, he's very grateful about for the help he had, but, I mean, you're talking about people who haven't got the support or want to live independently but need some support to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll give you an example, Sean. Well, in the last number of years, there's been no increase in personal assistance hours to people with disabilities. I'll give you an example from my own perspective. The only time I ever applied for a personal assistant, I actually don't have a personal assistant, but about 4 years ago, about 4 years ago, I applied to see how I would get on. Basically thinking about the future, Sean, and trying to remain as independent as I could. So the assessment was carried out on me through the criteria that they used. And to cut a long story short, basically, I was offered 2 hours a week.
2 hours for the whole week?
Yeah, now that, if you work that over 7 days, I think it works out at something like 17 and a half minutes a day.
Now, I know you, but not everybody is going to know your needs, and I don't know all your needs, but I know you use a wheelchair, for instance. I mean, what does that mean for you, not having that personal assistant?
Well, it just makes things more difficult, as you know. I mean, at the end of the day, Sean, I'm 46 years of age, and that was what I was thinking at the time was, you know, as you get older, things become more difficult, you know. Even, like, I find this last, over a good long time, really, transferring is very difficult, you know, from wheelchair to wherever, say, car or maybe the bed or a chair or whatever. Transferring is very difficult. And that's just one example, you know, where I could be doing with you know, assistance. But the idea of a personal assistant.
By the way, Frank, I mean, it's people need to realise that most of us would not want that in a million years for ourselves. You know, you're not saying this is a luxury I want. This is something that you're saying I need. I'd rather not have to want somebody to come and help me out of bed. But it's a need.
Sean, you've just hit the nail on the head. I absolutely don't want it, you know, but I realise that it's something that is going to make my life as manageable and as independent as I hope to remain, you know.
And why would they, how did they justify saying to you, Frank, that, you know, it has to use a wheelchair to get about, and you know, you have other issues. How did they justify saying to you, well, 2 hours a week will do you? I mean, how do you divide that up, and what would that be for?
Yeah, well, I appealed the case, Sean, and that exactly was my question. Like, how am I supposed to use 17 and a half minutes a day? And, you know, you don't get answers to those questions. You know, you just say, look, that's what you've been offered, and basically, what I took from it was take it or leave it, you know.
But well, somebody had to sit down in an office and look at your story, look at your history, look at your condition.
There's a criteria, Sean, and the criteria. No, they don't look at the history at all whatsoever. There's a criteria form that's filled in, and they ask you a load of questions, and there's a scoring system, and it's based on that. And that scoring system and that criteria is the same for everybody.
Okay, and you get 2 hours.
And, well, I didn't get them because I appealed it. I wouldn't know how to use 2 hours, Sean.
So what happened after the appeal?
After the appeal, I was still, the decision remained the same.
So you still didn't get more?
No, absolutely, I didn't get any. You know, I didn't take the 2 hours because I wouldn't know how to use 2 hours, so, you know, I mean, like, if I was to use 2 hours productively, I would basically have to use them in one day, and then I'd be left without a PA for the other 6 days of the week. You know.
Now, this is just you. One particular piece of help that you're looking for one person, you. But you're speaking tomorrow. You're going tomorrow to protest, not just for you, but for others with lots of other issues that they're not getting, or they feel they're not getting any help for. So yes, you're going to be protesting outside Leinster House from 12 until 4 o'clock tomorrow.
That's correct, Sonia. We haven't involved organisations or anything like that there. It's just basically a conversation that started on Facebook on Friday night. And, you know, I basically said, you know, well, what are we going to do about it? Somebody was venting their frustration at their situation. And I said, well, what are we going to do about it? And somebody else put the challenge up that we should go ahead with this tomorrow, and it sort of, I wouldn't say snowballed, but it certainly started off from there.
Okay. Now, Frank, how much of a handling is that for you personally now? Because, I mean, I can just get in the car and drive to Dublin and park up. I mean, how much of a handling is this?
Well, I mean,
you?
I could get into the car, but I mean, at the same time, Sean, you know, I wouldn't be that confident about driving in and around Dublin. So I basically will use public transport this evening. Two people will have to help me onto the bus. Two people will have to help me off the bus.
And who will do that?
I usually just ask two other passengers, Sean, and depend on the goodwill of other people.
What happens if they don't want to be lifting you off the bus?
What happens if... Sorry, could you repeat that, John?
If you got to Dublin, you're relying on passengers to help you and the goodwill. Yeah. And if there aren't two passengers willing to do that, so in other words, you have to think, oh, I hope to God now there's two passengers.
Yeah, it's very embarrassing asking people, you know, Sean, because, I mean, you know, I had a situation one time where I was at the bus station in Letterkenny, and I asked somebody, and thankfully, he had the sense to say, well, after having a major operation, and, you know, he couldn't help me. But, I mean, he might have felt maybe obliged to help me, you know, and God knows what would have happened.
So you're hoping people will come along, people in Dublin will come along and support you tomorrow?
It'd be great if we got support, Sean, but at the end of the day, you know, whether it's 100, 1,000, or whatever number of people are there, we'll be speaking on behalf of, you know, anybody who can't be there tomorrow.
Okay. Frank, thank you, and thanks for joining us.
Sean, thanks for all the time that you've given me on Highland Radio, and all the best for the future.
And the same to you. Thank you. Frank.
086 60 25,000. Your voice, your station. Highland Radio.
And the weather today, generally dry and sunny. Good. Cool early this morning, but it will become quite warm inland during the day with temperatures of 19 or 20 degrees. Isn't that gorgeous? And that was pretty much the way it was yesterday as well. So if you're able to, get out and enjoy it. Caller who contacts us, by the way, speaking of getting out and enjoying it, somebody was worried about Marble Hill and parking and all of that. Everyone should be entitled to enjoy the good weather at the beach, but the parking is beyond stupid. Big jeeps and cars parking on bad corners on both sides of the road with no regard to other road users. Caller says you would think that that GP was talking about GPs not getting very much. I have a medical card, and every time I go to a GP to get my bloods done, I'm charged €10. Is this the norm? Another caller says, these doctors who are crying about money, they have a turnover of over 400,000, yet they expect everything to be paid for. Young men, young people setting up a business can get the amount of money they do. Can't get that amount of money to start off. I don't know what that means. Young men, young people setting up a business can get the amount of money they do to start off. That must mean can't get. But anyway, he sort of dealt with that issue of people thinking that they're all getting loads and loads of money. He says that's practices that get that money, and it has to pay wages for everybody, and it's not all going to one GP, so people think that they're all earning millions, and that's a myth. That's basically what he's saying. Could you get something done for us, Sean, on Millbrae in Stranorla? All traffic goes this way. We can't get in or out because of cars speeding past. Houses shaking. Wow. When there's an event on, they park on both sides of the road in bad corners. We never seem to see the guards near where we live. Residents Association, come on, what are we doing about it? Millbrae in Stranorla, that's a question from a listener on the programme today. 0749 125,000. The US president's defended his son over emails released by Donald Trump Jr. about a meeting with a Russian lawyer. Now, Larry Donnelly is a lecturer in NUI Galway and political columnist with journal.ie. And Larry, hello and good morning.
Good morning, Sean.
So this incident with Donald Trump Jr., what's happened, Larry?
Well, evidently Donald Trump Jr. was contacted by email by a British publicist who represented several Russian celebrities, indicating that there was a Russian lawyer who would like to meet with him, and also that she had some information relative to Hillary Clinton having received campaign contributions from Russians, and that this would obviously be of benefit in terms of negative campaigning, that this would be of benefit to the Trump campaign. Donald Trump Jr. responded in an email effectively saying, if that's what it is, love it. Let's, you know, hopefully it'll be, we can use it later in the summer. The meeting then took place, and by all objective accounts, it was a short meeting, and not very much at all came from it.
Now, how's the White House? White House responding to this?
Well, the White House, you know, via Twitter as its usual medium of communication, the White House has said nothing except that Donald Trump Jr. is a high quality individual, that he's a great American, and that he last night he did an interview with Fox News, and that he did a great job, and that this was all again a witch hunt, and that they were out to get the president.
A witch hunt, but initiated by his son.
Yeah, effectively, I mean, in a sense initiated by his son. In terms of the revelation of the email, it was Donald Trump Jr. who put it all out on Twitter yesterday. That was, however, because the New York Times, which has been digging for a while now, the New York Times was going to release all of this. And when contacted, Donald Trump Jr. said, give me some time, I want to respond to what you're saying. And instead, he went to Twitter and released it all himself, therefore preempting the New York Times from doing so. And I think what's most noteworthy here is that Donald Trump, you know, Jr. is revealing himself to be a liar. liar. I mean, for many, many times he said he never had any contact with the Russians, and he maintained that position until he was basically put it backed into a corner by the New York Times.
Okay. I mean, this business of tweeting everything and, you know, the president does it and now his son's doing it in the White House is, I don't know what the staff feel about these things. They have to come out with these responses and they don't know what the president's going to do next. Are the American public getting tired of this? Or is there, I mean, I'm talking about Donald Trump supporters in the main. Is there any sign that they're getting tired of this, or is that what they want?
That's the big question. We don't know. And I think we need to differentiate between, as you said, Donald Trump's core base of hardline support. Clearly, they don't care. The key question, however, is what do Republicans more broadly and what I would call the soft Trump voters, that is the people who weren't going to the rallies and yelling and screaming, but people who voted for Trump because they wanted to give the system a kick or because they didn't like Hillary Clinton, what do they make of all of this? Because that's the key question. And in my view, even though this again falls short of the impeachment or treason or some of the things that people on the left have said, in my view, rather hysterically, even though it falls short of that, again, it's part of this drip of scandal that ultimately can't be good politically for the president or for his party.
Okay, Larry Donnelly, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
The lecturer in NUI Galway and political columnist with journal.ie, Larry Donnelly, joining us on the line there. 074-9125000. If you're phoning us, if you're texting us, 086-60-25000. Sean, I think it was sickening, the news about the coffin on the bonfire. Martin McGuinness is dead recently, and his family are still coming to terms with his death, and I think that was shocking. Now, I know that there have been quite a few comments similar to that following the news of this coffin image on the bonfire, which was aimed clearly at Republicans and Martin McGuinness's death, clearly. I mean, Donald, you've obviously been following this story, and I know that we've already heard from a local politician who's upset that his posters were put on a bonfire as well. And what the image, the coffin?
Yeah, it was a coffin with an effigy of Martin McGuinness in the coffin, and that was placed on one of the bonfires in Belfast. And as you say, there are posters. Pretty much every bonfire almost now will have election posters, tricolours, slogans. There was one with a particularly nasty.
The Sean Doherty Show, brought to you by the Errigal Arts Festival, from 4th to the 23rd of July. Fun for all the family. More info on eaf.ie.
Yes, indeed, and welcome back to the programme. And 074-9125000, if you're calling us this morning, or this afternoon, I should say, texts on 086-60-25000. And well done to Jimmy from All the Ruddies. That was another one. And Frank, by the way, who was on with us talking about the demonstration at Leinster House tomorrow. Frank, you're an inspirational man, and keep up your wonderful work. And that comes from your Facebook friend, Breege, who sent that message in to us in the last few moments, having listened to Frank. And the OD family called up to say good luck to Jimmy, good to hear you, and continued recovery. And nice to hear from the ODs as well, good friends from yours past as well. Well, the issue that was mentioned just before the news there, comments that have been made about burning the Orange Hall in Newton Cunningham online have been met with disgust, and of course also met with disgust have been the images that have been placed on some of the bonfires surrounding the celebrations on the 11th night. The 12th of July parades, of course, are taking place in 18 locations across Northern Ireland as the Orange Order stages the biggest day in its marching calendar. Stuart McLean from Newton Cunningham, he's on the line. In fact, he's about to march in Coleraine, so we've got a few minutes to catch up with Stuart. And Councillor Jack Murray is joining us as well. If I could go first of all to you, Stuart, before you march, and I can hear the music in the background, what's been happening on Facebook, Stuart?
Since we put out a press article on the laying of the foundation stone for Newton Cunningham Orange Hall and unfurling a new banner on the 4th of July, there's been quite a lot of adverse comments passed about the rebuilding of the hall, and some of it very which threatened to carry a further arson attack on it. Deeply concerns us, anything of that nature to any building, that somebody would have to come out and try and destroy it.
Given that it was already destroyed.
Yeah, it's been already destroyed, but we're just in the process of rebuilding. And as we go to rebuild, people are now looking to carry out further attacks on it, according to what comments have been placed on Facebook.
Okay. And Councillor Jack Murray, you're on the line too. Did you meet with Stuart? Good afternoon, first of all.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I met with Stuart at the hold yesterday evening in Newton Cunningham. Stuart made contact with myself as Cahillach of Finnishon and made me aware of the comments that were made and asked me to publicly condemn them. And I would do so without hesitation or reservation. Like those comments have absolutely no place in our society. No right-thinking person should make such comments. And I know that there's a very proud Protestant community in Donegal, particularly in South Finnishon. There's a large population there, and those people deserve to be respected, to have their culture respected, and to live safely within our communities without such threats or such sectarian comments.
And I'm sure those comments were relayed to you, Stuart, when you met Jack.
Oh, yeah, we deeply appreciated Jack's comments and for him to take the time to meet us last night. He represents the whole community of Finnishon, and he definitely has represented us with his comments there now to say that he condemns utterly and completely any act of violence against any part of society.
Okay, well, you wanted Jack to talk about something that's upset you, and I know a number of people have been quite upset with the burning of posters with images of you on, and of course the effigy of the coffin. The coffin containing an effigy of Martin McGuinness, who's been recently deceased, that has been placed on a bonfire. That's caused particular hurt.
Yeah, there's been a number of images again this year of bonfires across the 11th night bonfires across the six counties, with again a lot of tricolours, Sinn Féin election posters in particular being burned. My own poster was burned on Drumahoe a number of years ago, but as I just saw last night was the picture of Martin McGuinness in a coffin that got burned in East Belfast, and I just thought, well, Martin was a friend of mine, a man I very much look up to, a man who did a lot of work to reach his hand across the divide and build peace, and I just thought that was particularly hurtful to see those images of him being burned last night. And I would call again for that to be condemned across the board by people of all political persuasions, of all traditions, and then there should be a strong stance, particularly from in the unionist community, to stand against that.
Stuart, clearly you would have had no act part to play in this, but what do you think about that?
To desecrate the dead is unacceptable to anybody. Any right Christian minded person would have nothing to do with anything like that there. It's totally wrong. And I personally would condemn anything like that being placed anywhere near a bonfire. Anyone who is deceased has the right to be respected. And I think anybody within the order would concur with that, that nobody would want to see anything to do with that. The bonfires are not in the main controlled by the Orange. They're mainly from residents' associations or groups of individuals within housing estates, and therefore it's harder for the Orange, has no control over that. But it's totally and utterly wrong to do anything like that.
Are you surprised, both of you, I'm asking you, that this is happening now? I mean, we have this every year, don't we, that somebody gets offended by somebody putting up something that causes offence to them, and clearly on this occasion, both of you have been offended. Are you surprised that that's still happening or not? I mean, Jack, in all reality.
The scale of it, there's always going to be bigots or idiots in some society, but the scale of the bonfires and how widespread they are, I have to say now, I particularly welcome the comments made by Stuart. I think that's real leadership that was being shown, and I want to thank him for the comments that he made. I do feel that there's a need at the higher level, the leaders of the DUP, the political level of unionism in the North really need to make a stand on this, because while it's not been condemned at that level, it's going to continue. And I think people like Martin McGuinness showed leadership and the ability to reach a hand across the divide, and I think that has to be shown and reciprocated. And people need to act like Stuart just there now.
Are you surprised, Stuart, that this is still happening?
I know there's been a lot of work done throughout communities in Northern Ireland to try and minimise that, and it's something actually we're working with people from the Republican tradition and Derry and Strabane at the minute to try and build better bridges. unfortunately, as Jack said there, there's elements within society that show no respect to anybody, and it's how we'll never eliminate it, but it's how we can minimise that going forward. And I think there needs to be strides from the community leaders to make sure that it does come to a very end. And it doesn't happen alone just on the union side. It also happens on from the national side on the 15th of August, where unionist politicians end up in the bonfires. It's the same thing. It shouldn't happen in any case. It's disrespectful to anyone to have their photograph in any way put on a bonfire.
Okay, well, Stuart, I know you're about to march, and I hope you have a good day, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. All the best.
All the best. And Jack Murray, thank you as well.
Yeah, thank you, Sean.
Councillor Jack Murray there joining us. As a Donegal Protestant, I just want to express my disgust at what they did with these photos involving Martin McGuinness. We cannot all be tarred with the same brush. This is the work of extremists. And I think you've heard from both of the traditions there. You heard from Jack Murray from Sinn Féin. You heard from Stuart McLean there from the Orange Order, saying that they both totally condemn the actions of the people who were clearly very offensive in relation to the building of the Orange Hall in Newton Conneaut, and also those who put up this effigy of Martin McGuinness and all the other sectarian things that happened as well. So both of those people complimenting each other today, saying thank you for your support, thank you for your support, thank you for your condemnation, thank you for your condemnation. You just wonder if that couldn't be replicated a little bit more, we might have a better outcome. But anyway, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back just after these. The show here on Highland Radio, and just some little mess. I must say, if she's listening in, Deirdre Harkin, because I know she's on Facebook, and I think her parent or dad anyway still has a wee holiday cottage up there in Uris near Mamor Gap, which is where my family are from. And she was just looking at comments that would be made on Meleven and all that, and she sent a wee message to say, my auntie married with your mother and father. They had a double wedding, and I knew all about that, but I'd never come across Deirdre before. So Deirdre, if you're listening in this morning, hello to you, and hello to dad, and hello to all the family as well. It's a small world, isn't it? Now, In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America is a documentary. And it includes interviews with some of the big hitters, President Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, many US senators, congressmen, as well as leaders in Ireland as well, including and Britain as well, I should say, Britain, including Tony Blair and John Major. And the documentary is going to be shown, I'm told, at the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. Is it Galway? Yeah, and that's happening, as I understand it, tomorrow. Now, Maurice Fitzpatrick is the filmmaker and author and producer and director and writer of In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. And Maurice, first of all, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, Sean.
Now, your, relationship with Derry goes back quite a way. It's not. You've taken quite an interest in Derry over the years, Maurice.
I really have. I began my investigations into the culture and politics of Derry with a story called The Boys of St. Columns, which was a book and a film, and that was released in 2010, both the book and the film. And it features people like Seamus Heaney, Seamus Dean, John Hume himself, James Sharkey, ambassador of in his own extraction, I hasten to add, and Eamon McCann, Phil Coulter, many people from that milieu who went to St. Columb's College, which is a fundamental place in the psychology and of Derry. And the argument of that piece was that through getting educated, they started to ask questions of their society, and the civil rights movement formed 20 years after the Education Act, which enabled a lot of these boys to go to school. 20 years later, you had the civil rights movement, which was very Derry-centric. So I made that, and then I made a film on Brian Friel's translations, which, again, has an in its own resonance in that its setting is the very north, the very tip of Inishowen, Uris, And Brian Friel, of course, was a I believe he was a Donegal Man of the Year, and he was certainly many other things as well. A great, great writer. And
yeah.
I made a film for BBC on his translation. So this is now my third film and second book, and I'm focusing on John Hume and his dementia in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it's fascinating you say that, because my dad was from Uris too, and I've just been mentioning Uris because somebody sent in a request about a family link, and of course Brian Friel's connection, and I knew Brian Friel, and a remarkable man. But let's just talk about this, because I want to play a little clip of the documentary so people get a wee flavour of it. So let's have a listen to this.
Born into a background of injustice and division, John Hume was a decisive leader of the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland in 1968.
First, he was real. And secondly, he didn't seem to have an agenda other than the one he was pursuing. He wanted an inclusive peace. And he thought that nonviolence was the best way to pursue it. He was the Irish conflict's Martin Luther King.
John Hume resolutely pursued a peaceful path throughout the Northern Irish conflict.
Before we even got there, he opened fire.
This is the story of how John Hume harnessed the political influence of the Irish American diaspora to address that legacy of division and to achieve peace.
I think he understood language to be part of the problem, the ability to speak the language of the American politic better than them is a plus.
Tip took his lead of what John was saying. I would say in those days Tip was taking far more from John than he was from the Irish government, quite frankly.
The State Department was not in favor of what I did, as you may know, but I didn't really consult with them too thoroughly.
There was some broken china there. There were, you know, I had a lot of trouble with the British for a brief period, but I trusted Hume's instincts.
But then you had the American influence, which was a very strange thing for British politics.
It wasn't just the risk of alienating the British. It was also the risk that I would stick my neck out and IRA violence would continue and I would look like I'd been played for a fool.
I am standing here and telling the government that I believe that we have a real process of lasting peace and a total cessation of violence. Hurry up and deal with it.
He grabbed me by the wrists and held my hands and said, look, you can do it. You're near it.
In 1998, the Good Friday Agreement was signed and roundly endorsed in referenda on both sides of the Irish border, and the Northern Irish Troubles ended. Hume's strategy had become a political reality.
And talking to Maurice Fitzpatrick, filmmaker and author, producer, director and writer of In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. That is some cast list, Maurice.
Well, they're all wonderful people, and I think Liam Neeson's wonderful voice permeating there and Bill Whelan's musical score brings it out with very senior political figures, and they all were lined up to state the record of what happened right back to the 60s and to assert what John's political role was in recent Irish history.
Were you worried or concerned that his part in the whole history was not being told properly? I mean, I know Eamon McCann, I think, in the documentary makes a very strong point about that. Was that one of the concerns?
Yeah, it's something actually that features. There was a profile by Donald Clark in the Irish Times last Saturday, and the way in which history has been subtly, sometimes not so subtly, rewritten. Was I concerned? Well, I think I had a story to tell, and that story could stand up and have its own integrity. I wasn't overly working against a tendency that does exist to, as it were, downplay the role of John and John Hume and others. But I think that what above all, the motivation was to tell a story and then let the audience be the judge.
Yeah, I mentioned Eamon McCann's intervention. He has a particular story to tell, and I think it goes back to the bog side and hearing somebody telling the history to people who were visiting school children, maybe, and he was a bit irked at it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, that's quite correct. And he's a bit irked, and it's very compelling coming from Eamon, because Eamon is not of the SDLP, neither is he of Sinn Féin. Yeah. He's very much his own person, and People Before Profit Alliance is his, affiliation in terms of political movement. But Eamon was speaking there about, he's lived through this history himself, a core architect of the First Civil Rights Movement march in Derry on the 5th of October, 68. So he's seen it. When there was a suggestion that John Hume really came on the scene by talking to Gerry Adams in the late 80s, he knows that's inherently false. And he wanted to, I find it very compelling coming from him, because, down the years, he and John would have been political rivals, and he certainly doesn't have any political gain to make out of mounting that defense of John's record and John's reputation. So, yeah, it's there. It's very much there, the way in which time passes, memories fade, and indeed, let's remember, there's new generations come along who would not have been so steeped in the story, and it's probably up to the teachers of history, writers of history, dare I say it, makers of historical documentaries, to try to get the facts and the story straight.
And the link to America and this unbelievably, remarkable connection he had with America and this access he had to the White House, where did all that come from?
That came out of what you could call a very happy marriage between John Hume's view that the power of America, that the interest, the potential interest that could exist in political circles in Washington, D.C., could be harnessed to bring that influence to bear on the Northern Irish situation. So he had that key insight, and it was a very important one. Married to that, you had the very natural, you could almost say innate, sympathy on the part of prominent U.S. politicians. I mean, Tip O'Neill, again, Inish Owen features a lot in this story. Major Inish Owen and Bun Cranaman, Tip O'Neill and Senator Ted Kennedy, they were core supporters from the get-go. They did need a person in the form of John Hume to, as it were, say what was required and illustrate the complexities of the political scene in the North. It was quite important to have, as one senator put it to me in the film, to have an instructor. That's the way they saw him.
Although, when you look back now, it's hard to understand how you managed to get a nationalist to go to America and for America then to be an honest broker in the situation, because, of course, another side will say, well, if he's initiated this, then it's going to be biased. How did he manage that?
Oh, well, if I've understood you correctly, the unionist critique may have been, that this is biased because it's coming from, out of the energies and initiative of a nationalist politician. There was that critique, certainly. But what was also important was there was a great imbalance back home. And in a way to try to rebalance things, to make America sit up and pay attention, and make, in turn, the British sequences of British governments to take a very definite, more an egalitarian stance, much more egalitarian stance than had it prevailed. I think that was necessary. And if, from some unionists' point of view, say there was a unionist politician bemoaned the fact that there wasn't a Friends of the Union caucus on Capitol Hill in the United States. Well, I think, I don't know what John Hume would have said about that, but I think he might have said, well, why don't you go and create one? it's an open field, and where there's the Friends of Ireland, there's also an appetite to learn more about the unionist view, and it's important to do that politically. It's important to build that interest, and you know, neither he nor anyone else could have stopped that from happening. It was as I say, an open field.
Okay, and this documentary is going to be shown tomorrow night in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. So when will everybody else get to see it?
Well, everyone else, you know, I think there's still tickets going, so there's a possibility of coming here. But
it's a long journey.
Well, a long but worthwhile journey, I'll say. The good people of Galway, the Galway Film Fla, that's how it's happening and why it's happening here. It's part of the Galway Film Fla, and they've organised a wonderful Fla this year, and this is taking place in the middle of it. It's 4 p.m. tomorrow on Thursday, and there will be a panel discussion following the screening, and beyond that, of course, there will be screenings in other parts of the country. I am working with, I mean, this is very much the maiden voyage, so I'm still working it out, but there are wonderful places in Donegal, Derry, and, of course, throughout the country. I'd like to screen it, so watch this space.
Yeah, and Maurice, obviously this has been shown at an event, and you're hoping to show it at other locations, but when will it go onto the TV, and when will we get to sit down and watch it on the telly? I mean, they are the plans, I presume, are they?
Oh, yeah, it will be screened. I mean, one of the co-funders of the project is RTE.
Yeah.
So, that, again, I can't, quote chapter and verse to you about when it will screen then, but maybe we'll have another discussion around that time.
And, Maurice, what do you think, at the end of all of this, what do you think we will learn, you know, without giving away the whole documentary, when we, you know, you've put together a big cast list here, what do you think we will learn that we didn't know before?
Well, I suppose there are a number of things, but what is certainly, I would say without any hesitation, true about this film and book, is that John Hume's American dimension hasn't been fully explored before, and now it has been in this, in the form of this film and book. So there's that, and what one learns is that by going to the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, and by gaining influence and interest among senior politicians who would then in turn help to, as it were, open up the White House, open up a channel to get White House involvement, which is, of course, what foreign policy, above all, comes from there, the State Department and the White House. What do you learn? You learn that this was very strategically brilliant move. And in the case where there was this Anglo-Irish imbroglio and, you know, what seemed to many people to be an unresolvable conflict in the North, by bringing in another very powerful sphere and, as it were, reconfiguring the whole problem, there's a great lesson in it for, you know, a belief in politics and a belief in political construction.
And people are bound, Maurice, to look at the context now and, you know, compare and wonder if it were now, could it have happened?
Well, that's a tricky one because, of course, time passes and the world has changed, never mind Northern Ireland and Ireland and so on. But if it were now, I think what we do need is the absolute commitment to negotiation, to the political process, to partnership. And that's sadly lacking. I mean, the negotiations at Stormont, I was in Belfast not so long ago and speaking to visiting students, some American students were there, and then, you know, you had to kind of explain, well, oh yeah, one of the problems here is the renewable heating scheme that went wrong, and the other problem is an Irish Language Act, and is this why there's a suspension of government? It really is not a great reflection on the authors of these various problems and conflicts and impasses. So I think, yeah, very much, I mean, it could happen. It need, and not only does, could it happen in the sense that negotiation would be put to the fore, Sean, but it needs to happen.
Well, good luck tomorrow night with the world premiere, the first showing of this new documentary, In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. And thanks very much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks to you. Thanks for the call.
Thanks. Maurice Fitzpatrick there, the filmmaker and author and producer, director and writer of In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. We'll be back after these.
Call Sean now on 074-91-25000.
Okay, welcome back to the programme. Now, there was an incident north of Tory Island this morning. The lifeboat was called to respond to it. The press officer with Lochs Willie Lifeboat, Joe Joyce, is on the line. Joe, good afternoon. What happened, Joe?
Good afternoon, Sean. Sean, at about 10 to 12, we got a request for assistance from the Marine Rescue Centre there at Malinhead. A diver had gone into difficulty there off Tory Island, about 17 miles north of Tory Island. They were doing a deep dive there in about 80 metres of water. They had, one of the divers suffered a rapid descent. That has a number of medical complications. People would know it as the bends. Lochs Willie Lifeboat was tasked to that shout, along with the rescue helicopter there based out of Sligo, Rescue 118.
So, just to be clear, Joe, there were a number and are a number of divers there. It's quite a deep dive. And this diver basically came to the surface too quickly, and that can cause catastrophic consequences and certainly not very pleasant at its very least. So, you were called as a reason. That was the reason you were called.
That's the reason we were called, yeah. So when people are diving, Sean, the deeper they go, there are certain rules. You have to have what they call out gas when you come to the surface, and that can be it's a very staged process depending on the depth that you're at. So the deeper the dive, the longer you have to wait at certain levels in the water. So the other divers are still down there. They're out gassing at the moment, but this guy came up. The Rescue 118 arrived and seen there. The diver there was medically assessed, and he should be landing there at Letterkenny University Hospital there any time now.
And you mentioned the other divers. They're still coming up to the surface because they would have to, the reason they wouldn't be up now is because they have to come up in a staged process, and the problem here would have been that something went wrong in this case.
At that kind of depth, Sean, you're usually using what they would call mixed gases, different mixes. Coming up there from that kind of depth, you come so far and you stop. You have what they call a safety stop, and you change gases out, and you come up another bit, and you change again. And you wait, and all the time your body is getting rid of the toxic gases that have built up in the system. And gradually then you come to the surface. So that can be a slow process depending on the depth of the dive.
And do we know the condition of this diver?
We didn't actually get to medically assess him. That was the crew of Rescue 118. So he's been taken to Letterkenny General Hospital. Is all we can say about that.
And do we know where he's from?
Again, we have limited information on that, Sean.
Okay. Well, Joe, thanks for the update and thank you for joining us.
No bother. Thank you, Sean.
So that was an incident at about 20 to 12. It's only a very, very recent, within the last hour or so, 17 miles north of Tory Island, and this diver who has... I can just hear the helicopter going over Highland Radio as we speak, actually, obviously to the hospital. It's just, I can hear it in my ears now. The helicopter's about to arrive at the University Hospital. I can just hear it now, actually, as we were speaking, with this patient on board, this diver, who's obviously surfaced too quickly, and the bends is the issue there, and that obviously can be very, very serious. So we are obviously hopeful that he will be okay. It's coming up to 20 to 1, and nice and warm. Nice weather to be here. Barbara, hello to you.
Hello, Sean. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks, Barbara. You're just back from America, aren't you?
After being spent 3 months out and with my family, mostly babysitting, right? But I also had a good time, and I met a lot of friends, met a lot of Irish people from different parts of Ireland. And the first thing they kept asking me, about the Troubles. And I kept saying, no, everything's fine, we're in peacetime.
Mm.
And then this happens, and I heard you on the radio the day, I'm only back about a week, heard about the burning of the coffin of Martin McGuinness, which I think is a total disgrace, and the burning of picture of some sportsman or something?
Well, there's a number of things burned. There was a statue of the Blessed Virgin. There was another thing. There was also, of course, and let's remember this, we had Stuart McLean on, the new Orange Hall in Newton Conyngham that they're building.
That's right.
That the other one was burned down, a horrific attack on that, and people putting up comments saying, oh, this one should be burned down, you know, so that's what we were discussing. It was unfortunately. Now, on a positive note, we had a member of the Orange Order and a Sinn Féin representative both thanking each other and congratulating each other for their responses to both situations, which, again, wouldn't have happened a number of years ago, as you probably know.
Yeah.
So, which is
I've been listening to it.
Yeah. But what surprises me is that you say that when you're in America, that they're still talking about, is there
trouble.
Peace? Yeah.
And they are actually, what I'll say, scared about coming up to Inishowen because of one of my best friends and her husband are coming. I invited them over and they're coming in September. And they were quizzing me about the troubles because they intended to fly into Belfast and come up to Derry and through on through. Now that's all going to change because, of course, what will they say? Will they say they're scared or frightened? When they hear this.
Well, that's if they do hear it. I mean, this is. I'm not certain this will reach American news channels. Now, the way the websites work now, it depends what they're looking at. You know, I mean, everything's local now, isn't it?
But, I was able to listen to you when I was out in America. My daughter had her iPad, and she used to put me on for you and John Breslin.
Yeah.
And sometimes in the afternoon, what do you call your man that does all the country and western?
Gary,
I love my music. And we got very sentimental at times.
Where were you in America? Whereabouts were you?
Long Island.
Oh, so you're near New York, and obviously there's a lot of Irish people.
Oh, I had a great time and made a lot of friends. And actually, there's a busload coming in the beginning of January, about 40 or 50 on it. But they are coming to Killarney. They're not coming up to the north at all. They wouldn't touch it. Because of the troubles. They still think that we're in a wartime, do you understand?
Well, I'm surprised to hear that.
And I was trying to tell them, no, we're in peacetime, and everything's okay. And, of course, I used to tell them about the weather, and maybe they'd be lucky that they might get good weather, and they might just, but they don't mind, they don't mind the rain.
But they'd still be nervous of coming up north.
Yes, yeah. And this is definitely going to set them back, I think. And I condemn it. Like, I think it's terrible what's happening, and it's only just a certain crowd that's doing this. I know the Protestant people and the Catholic people get together, and we're good friends. And in fact, I would contribute towards that church that's been rebuilt.
Oh, it's an orange, the Orange Hall,
yeah.
I mean, go on, sorry.
I'm an Irish Catholic mother, but I would have no problem contributing towards that, the building of it. It wouldn't be much, but it would be a help.
Well, you know, attitudes like that, I think, are more telling. But, you know, I think that what can we do other than for you to say to people in America that there is no concern for their safety. There's no need for them to be worried. I mean, it's like people saying, I wouldn't go to New York because I've heard there are so many people shot or whatever, you know. You know, I mean, you just, that's not what the way people think, is it? I hope not, anyway, you know.
No.
But it's, you'd have thought at this point, let's put it that way, Barb, you'd have thought at this point in time, particularly Irish Americans who you were meeting, you'd think they would have got the message at this point that, and even during the Troubles, let's be honest about it, it was still mostly safe for most people. There were certain areas that they might have been nervous about, certainly, but like that Donegal and certainly in Inishowen should never have been a concern, even though people thought, oh, well, that's up in the north and, you know, it got that kind of name. But saying that, even during the height of the Troubles, I mean, I was here and family members came over and there was never an issue. Okay, the security thing was different and people seen soldiers and people seen police with guns and all of that. And, people would have found that interesting, unusual, but people still came who knew me, and that there was yeah. no big issue. But it's sad to hear that people would still be frightened to come.
Yeah. Well, actually, I have another friend, and he's a retired chief officer in the police in New York, but he's retired. But he comes here twice a year. And when he comes, he flies into Belfast and hires a car and comes on to Bunkranagh. No trouble at all with him.
Well, there isn't.
He always came too for like Graveyard Sunday that we have, and he is coming now. But he's changed his flight, and he's going to fly Aer Lingus into Dublin and come up that way.
Why?
Because he's hearing all this news in Northern Ireland.
But the only thing he'd be hearing, surely, is... that they haven't managed to negotiate a new government. I mean, he's not hearing that there are shootings and bombings and...
Oh, no. But I think that is going to have an awful effect on the tourist trade, all of this. And it is going to put a lot of people in America from coming there.
Well, I think in America, and I don't mean this in any disrespectful way, but Americans are very sensitive to this kind of issue, yeah. as you know, and they will not go anywhere where they think there's the slightest... A lot of Americans yeah. would say, oh, well, because you don't have to leave America, do you? You can just... It's so big.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been watching the TV out there, and you'd be shocked. And every day there's something different. Murders and car crashes and people killed. It was shocking.
That's the point. I mean, like, if you look at American television, you'd be yeah. local television, you'd be seeing shootings and knives yeah. and all of that going on.
Yeah.
And you'd never go out of the door.
And into schools and killing maybe 40 or 50 or 70 children. Oh, it was shocking. I couldn't believe it. Although, out where I was living in Long Island, it was lovely, quiet and peaceful. It was a small village, something like Bunkranagh. And beautiful and lovely, and they have their own police force, and there's no violence or nothing. Hardly ever seen any trouble on it.
In Long Island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I'm a bit worried now about my friend maybe changing her mind about coming when she hears all about this morning.
I don't know how she will. I would say you should be calling her and having a chat to her, and if this conversation yeah. comes up, I would be reassuring her, like I would be reassuring anyone yeah. myself if they said that to me and say, you'll have no problem, you'll have a wonderful yeah. holiday, you'll have a peaceful holiday, and the thing you'll notice most is the warmth of the people. I mean, that's what people say when they come here. That's why they come back.
Yeah. I think they should be allowed to have their marches. We have our marches. We have our St. Patrick's Day marches. We have our Easter marches, and we just let them get on with it. It's peacetime.
Okay. Well, Anna's on the line too. Anna, hello.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Good afternoon. Now, you watched a programme about cruise ships coming into Belfast.
Yes, I did indeed. But I don't want to be critical in any way of tour guides, but the point that I would like to make, Sean, is this, that I think that there's a big onus on tour guides to convey a nice message about Ireland and about north of Ireland, particularly, you know, Ulster in particular. Because I think that some people might be getting the wrong impression of what life is like now in the north of Ireland. So I think that the onus is on tour guides to send people, particularly Americans who don't understand all this business, you know, of Catholics and Protestants and all this kind of stuff. I just, you know, the point is, Sean, basically tour guides have a big onus on them to send people away with a different impression of Northern Ireland, that peace is now here, thankfully, you know, and that's not the way it used to be.
And you think that some of them focus on the troubles too much?
Well, I think perhaps,
I mean,
you know,
get bus trips to areas where, you know, and they will talk, but isn't that what, I mean, there is an element of historical interest there, you know?
Oh, there most certainly is, you know, but, you know, I think it shouldn't be laboured on. I think they should be give two views of it, like, you know. I did the open-top bus for quite a while in Derry.
Yeah.
You know, and I always tried to give an even account of the troubles, you know, and I don't mean to be boosting myself up, but I was complimented on several occasions because I just think people are being sent away with them. I think there's just too much emphasis put on Catholics and Protestants, you know, when the whole thing is really political in a sense.
Yeah. And when they would hear my accent, they knew I was from Inishowen or Donegal. Yes. So that's why they kept quizzing me and asking me about it.
I think it's sad to hear that people in America, some are still afraid to come here because they have nothing to be afraid of. But Barbara and Anna, thank you both for joining us.
Okay, right. Sean, thank you very much.
Sean, when I come back, I got the shock of my life when I heard you were leaving.
Yeah.
Oh. Anyway, I wish you all the best. And I will miss you. And I always listen to John Breslin first and you. And I enjoyed the programs up to 1 o'clock.
Oh, that's great. Thanks a lot, Barbara.
And good luck for the future.
And keep listening. Bye-bye.
All right.
It's 3 minutes to 1. That's all we've time for on the program. Thank you very much for your calls and thanks for your comments. And thanks to our producer today, Kira Johnson, assisted by Caroline Orr. And have yourselves a lovely day. Slán agus banacht. Enjoy the nice weather. Bye-bye.